Jeremy Faludi teaches and researches sustainable design at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. Dr. Faludi emphasizes the importance of systems thinking and life cycle assessments. His book, Sustainable Design, Vision to Action, provides tools and methods for designing more sustainable products and systems.
One of the things that I teach people in this book is how to run the numbers on things, how to do a life cycle assessment yourself, or at the very least, how to look up an LCA that other people have done. Or in fact, we include a bunch of pre-calculated LCAs of different product categories in the book so that you can sit there and say, okay, I'm designing a t-shirt, or I'm designing an office chair, or I'm designing a mobile phone. What are the biggest environmental impacts? Probably. So where should I spend my design time and effort?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm here with my co-hosts, Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. And I am John Lebkoski. Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Faludi, a sustainable design strategist and researcher. He teaches at Delft University of Technology. He's the lead author of Sustainable Design from Vision to Action, and he's contributed to six other books, including World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century, where I was also a contributor. And he designed the first version of the biomimicry database, AskNature.org. And a bicycle he helped design was exhibited in the Smithsonian Cooper Hewitt Museum. Over 30 companies have used his whole system mapping method. And he wrote the OECD's recommendations to governments on green 3D printing. And that makes me feel like a real slacker, Jer. You've done a lot more than I have. But we did both have the world-changing experience.
Exactly.
And that was good.
Yeah.
That
it's was good great. To talk to you again.
It's great to see you again, too. It's been years, hasn't it?
It has.
So what led you to focus your career on sustainable design?
Well, mostly because the world needs it, but... there are a lot of things the world needs that I would not be good at. Like the world really needs environmental lawyers. It really, really needs that. But I am just not the right kind of person for that. It's not my personality style to be fighting in court all the time. I'm a fun, creative guy. So I want to come up with new ideas that could be positive solutions to things. And then design is one of the few places where it's okay to both be creative and analytical, because, I've got some scientists to me, but I've also got some artists to me. And design is one of those few places where it's really nice to have both.
And what makes sustainable design sustainable?
It depends on what you're designing, and that's actually part of what the book is about, is how to figure out what you should focus your design time and effort on. If you're designing furniture, then it's mostly about the materials that you choose and also about how sturdily you build things. Whereas if you're designing a refrigerator, it's all about how efficient it is energy-wise. Or if you're designing a computer, it's kind of a combination of the energy use and the materials. But here, the materials of the case, whether it's metal or plastic, whatever, that doesn't really matter. It's more about the electronics and, how long you can get the electronics to last, designing for repair and upgrade and remanufacturing. So what makes a design sustainable totally depends on what the product is or the service or the system.
In the United States, there have been many attempts to create sustainable products, and some have failed because of a problem with recycling has not proved to be available as we once hoped it would be. You know, there's so many places where they are sending the recycling and it ends up going into the dump.
Yeah, I mean, here in Europe, we have double or triple the recycling rates that the U.S. does for most materials, and that's just a failure of government. You can design for that, but honestly, designing for recycling is kind of the bottom of the barrel in terms of our strategies. Refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle. There's a reason that recycle is kind of at the end of the list there, because if you quantify the environmental impacts of things, recycling does help, but it usually doesn't help as much as making your product last twice as long, like I said a minute ago, by making it more repairable, upgradable, or just more durable. Or for some things, like with a refrigerator, it doesn't really matter what materials you use, as long as it's energy efficient. You might think that you're making a green decision by replacing the spray foam polyurethane with recycled chopped up blue jeans, because the material is greener. It's a reused or recycled material. But just because the R value of those chopped up blue jeans is like half of the R value for spray foam polyurethane, and energy use is like 90% of the impact of a refrigerator, it's actually better to use the material that's a bit nastier, because in the big picture, if you look at the whole system, it's making much bigger improvements in impact.
I have a Fairphone, which I think is Dutch also, and that, I really resented the thing of not being able to replace the battery, for example. And so, for years I said my next phone will be a Fairphone, and one day the old phone finally stopped connecting to things, and I'd had that one for 10 years. So the Fairphone is hoping you'll get 10 years out of this one. I'm hoping I'll get 15,
Yeah, I hope so. And yeah, actually Fairphone, those are TU Delft graduates.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and that's a perfect example of great design. And like the reason that they're called Fairphone is that their original plan was to make phones where they sourced the materials fairly. I'm sure you've heard of conflict minerals like blood diamonds, and in the case of your phone, it's more the tantalum and cobalt for things like capacitors and other electronic components, and also the gold. Their original goal was to do basically fair trade sourcing of those minerals for their supply chain. But then once they were looking at it for a longer time and thinking about it in the bigger system, they're like, well, it would be stupid of us to just design a normal phone with good materials, because like I was saying earlier, if you can make the phone last for twice as long or three times as long, then that is even better. And so that's why they're the best phone in the world for design for repair and upgrade as well.
I know Apple recycles things like rare earth minerals, for instance, that they use in their iPhones. So,
yeah, but on the Fairphone, if they make a new camera, you can buy a module and just upgrade the camera. You don't have to upgrade the whole phone.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yep. So it's things like that. And if the screen breaks, you can order a screen and you can put it in yourself. It's really designed to help, it's designed like an old car. where you can actually, you can take it apart in your driveway and replace parts.
It's not designed for planned obsolescence.
Right. Exactly. It's like the framework laptop. That's a similar approach, I think.
Yeah, the framework people were inspired by Fairphone.
The day they get a touch screen.
I'm remembering this phrase cradle to cradle. Is that sort of in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the chapters in the book is on cradle to cradle and circular economy together, because basically the circular economy is sort of it's not new anymore, but it's sort of still the hot thing that people have been talking about for a long time. But it's basically just cradle to cradle with a business model. And which, is not to minimize that, because the business model part of it is super important. Like, that's how you can convince companies to not do planned obsolescence anymore. But yeah, cradle to cradle is still a classic that we teach, that kind of biocycle and technical cycle thinking.
And I'm just in this image that I'm showing, it shows that in cradle to cradle there's both a biological cycle and a technical cycle.
Yep, exactly. And then in circular economy, they took that further to sort of combine those two cycles with the I forget what company it was that originated it. It was way back in the 90s, but there's a copier company, not Xerox. I forget what the other company was that was the first one to draw one of these sets of circles of, like I was saying before, where recycling is your sort of last resort. That's the furthermost cycle. And closer in, the closer loops are reusing, remanufacturing, repairing. And actually, another circular economy tool that we teach in the book is called the Value Hill, which is a version of that that is reminding companies that when you're getting these tighter cycles of, like longer lifetime and reuse versus recycling and whatnot, not only are you saving a lot of environmental impacts because you're not having to spend all the energy and use all the materials of manufacturing again, but you're also saving money because, with your phone, your phone has like maybe a dollar or two worth of gold in it. So if you just shred it and, recycle it for the materials, not only are you losing all the energy that you put into manufacturing it, you're losing like $800 of economic value as well, because the materials value of your phone, is a couple dollars worth of gold, a few dollars worth of copper and silver and whatever else. But the vast majority of the value is in the manufacturing that they did to, turn those raw materials into a phone.
Yeah, in the United States, there is a problem with the electronics recycling. I had some friends who had seen on the dark web advertisements for old hard drives that were being sold. People were going to these recycling locations and ripping out all the hard drives were there. And a lot of people don't understand that you can take that hard drive and strip the data off of it, and it has their whole life, for these people to use, credit card numbers, passwords, all that sort of thing. And unfortunately, people just don't get educated in things as basic as don't send like something like that out into the wild, because it'll come back and haunt you.
Yeah, and there's software tools you can use to prevent that, actually. Things that you can do that will basically erase the entire hard drive and then overwrite it with like random garbage and erase it again, overwrite it with random garbage again, and do that like five times so that it erases any of the previous imprint of your data.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I have a stack of old computers and hard drives around here where I keep thinking that I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that someday.
I read a story in The Guardian this morning about an auction house that gets sent all of the lost suitcases if they're not claimed within 3 months. And they auction them off. And this journalist bought three suitcases, and you have to figure out how to get them open and look at the contents. But it's quite often the suitcase is worth more than you paid for the whole lot, but from what she says. But, it's the same thing, isn't it? I mean, you don't know what people might have left in their suitcase. They might have left their entire address book and their checkbook. Who knows?
Or their laptop.
Yeah.
Well, and talking about the concept of the circular economy, concept of sustainability, some other related concepts like green and renewable energy, that sort of thing. There seems to be a political backlash against those concepts. Certainly in the United States, we were talking before you came on, we had talked about the controversy in the U.S. about wind energy. Now, wind energy is producing a rather large amount of the energy that's available for use in the U.S., yet you have people who want to do away with it entirely, including our president here. I'm wondering, do you encounter people who have these kind of strange biases against, circular and sustainable thinking? How do you talk to people like that?
Yeah, that is a good question. Because the Trump and wind energy thing, that's just completely irrational tribalism. Because wind energy is actually a huge benefit for rural farmers. So much of Iowa is covered in wind farms now, and it's a significant chunk of revenue for lots of farmers. And Texas is one of the biggest wind power states in the whole country, and also really big on solar as well. Like, they just make great economic sense for people. So that's just people acting against their own self-interests due to tribalism. But thankfully, no, I don't need to deal with those people generally. It's not never.
Where would the Netherlands be without wind?
Right, exactly. Yeah, the Netherlands was doing wind.
Are the Netherlands the original windmill?
Exactly. Like, literally, there is a 400-year-old windmill in Delft that still works. It still grinds grain into flour that you can buy bread, at their little gift shop. That's been one of the great things about living in the Netherlands generally, is that sustainability is, like, it's not a radical thing here. It's an ordinary daily life thing. Like, even the conservative political parties are still in favor of not all sustainability things, but a lot of them. And we've been switching over our grid to renewables, have made huge strides just in the 6 years that I've lived here. Public transport is everywhere in the Netherlands. And I don't own a car. Most people I know don't own a car. You can bicycle and take the train almost everywhere. We have more kilometers of bicycle paths here in the Netherlands than in most of the rest of Europe put together, much less the United States. And the entire national train system runs on 100% renewable electricity. Like, I can even take a high-speed train to Paris. You know, I can get from here to Paris in 3 hours on a train that runs on 100% renewable electricity. And that's just the default. That's just the way it is. You know, there are buildings in The Hague that have the stickers of the UN Sustainable Development Goals that they work for, you know, in the windows, 2 meters on a side. And honestly, most of Europe is, 10 or 20 years ahead of the US in terms of sustainability. Not because we have any better technology here. In fact, a lot of the technology gets invented in the US first, honestly. It's just that we have less corrupt politics. And so things that are actually good for people get implemented at scale here and, you know, get turned into law and financial incentives.
Well, when it comes to things that are good for people, in this country, the marketing industry loves to greenwash things. They say it's plant-based. Yep, plant-based meat. No, what? Gluten-free, sustainably farmed. And a lot of times you look behind the scenes and no, it's not. It's just the same old thing that someone stamped, you know, green good. It's green, it's sustainable, and it's not. How do you deal, and how does the EU deal with stuff like that? Do you encounter that similar thing from marketers in the EU?
That does sometimes happen here, although the laws are much stricter on what marketing claims you can make. And actually, even in the US, the FCC made the laws much stricter just 2 or 3 years ago or something about what you can legally claim. What's that?
I think you mean the FTC, Federal Trade Commission.
Oh, probably. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's all gone. You know, yeah, change that.
Probably. Yeah. But actually I have, you're right that some greenwashing is malicious and manipulative, but I actually think, I've worked with a lot of companies, and I actually think that most greenwashing is well-intentioned ignorance. Like, that doesn't necessarily make it better in terms of the end result. Like, the end result is still misleading manipulation. But I think most of it is done out of ignorance. And actually, that was one of the reasons that I wrote this book and teach sustainable design generally, is because, I've had companies, even 20, 25 years ago, did a gig for this company that makes hair dryers. And they were very proud of themselves because they had just done this sustainability initiative. They had told their design and engineering groups to reduce the amount of plastic in the case of the hair dryer. And they were, about to launch this big marketing campaign around it. And I ran the numbers for them. I did a life cycle assessment to quantify the environmental impacts of that. And I said, hate to break it to you guys, but this design initiative that you've just spent, 6 months or 9 months and however many $100,000 on, was basically a waste of your time because it's kind of bullshit. Because the vast majority of the environmental impacts of a hairdryer are in the energy that it uses. Those things use like 1800 watts of power. But they didn't know that because they hadn't sat down to run the numbers. And so one of the things that I teach people in this book is how to run the numbers on things, how to do a life cycle assessment yourself, or at the very least, How to look up an LCA that other people have done. Or in fact, we include a bunch of pre-calculated LCAs of different product categories in the book so that you can sit there and say, okay, I'm designing a t-shirt, or I'm designing an office chair, or I'm designing a mobile phone. You know, what are the biggest environmental impacts? Probably. So where should I spend my design time and effort?
Have you worked much on sustainable design for healthcare?
Actually, right now I have two PhDs working on that. So one PhD is doing circular economy redesigns of medical devices, specifically like digital healthcare devices. And then the other one is, it's interesting, not doing product design at all, but doing life cycle assessments to help redesign clinical trials for pharmaceutical drug development for Johnson & Johnson.
I have the impression that going kind of more digital, using more digital technology, helps or supports sustainable healthcare design. Is that correct?
It totally depends. Like the PhD that I have that's doing green redesigns of various products, two out of the four products are products that used to be just ordinary plastic or metal things, you know, like a pillbox that now is a smart pillbox. A laparoscopic surgery device that used to just be operated by hand, but now is motorized and electronic. And in both of those cases, the environmental impacts of making it digital are way worse, because the electronics has easily 10 times the environmental impact of all of the, you know, plastic in a pillbox. And I forget if it's 10 times the impact of the steel and titanium and stuff that's in the laparoscopic surgery device, but it's much more. It's at least five times as much, if not 10 times as much. So just making things digital is definitely not an improvement by itself, but when making things digital makes it easier for you to reuse them or share them among lots of people, then it can be a big benefit. Because like back in when I lived in the US, I had Zipcar, you know, one of these car share services, so that I didn't have to have a car of my own because I didn't need one most of the time. But that is something where, you know, in the city of San Francisco, there were, I don't even know, probably 1,000 different cars. And, you know, you can only reserve it for a certain amount of time and you have to pay, you know, by the hour. And so you have this access key card thing and you make an appointment on the website. Like if we were trying to do that with physical car keys and a paper calendar, and like, that would just be a non-starter. Like it just would not be physically possible. So that's a case where putting in electronics does very much help the sustainability side.
No, I remember being told ages and ages ago about a website that there were all these, it was something about renting a yacht, I think, and there were all these Greek, yeah, you know, owners of boats and things, you know, sort of sitting in tavernas, and the website made it, but it was a very simple website. It was, you know, you still had to, I think you still had to phone them, but it made it more accessible really for the first time. I wanted to go back though to what you were saying about one of your PhD students. What needs to be done to make health to clinical trials more sustainable? What's unsustainable about them?
Oh yeah, I mean, part of it is the energy and materials for making the drugs. Just because when things are in a, you know, research stage, they haven't gone through all the sort of scaling for efficiency and economies of scale and stuff. But surprisingly, the biggest environmental impact, the biggest single environmental impact was transportation, which is really rare because I know that people often think that transportation is a really big deal, like, oh, the locally grown vegetables are way more green. That's not true. Like for almost all food, the impacts of transportation are a rounding error, even if they're grown in like Argentina and shipped to the US. It's not always true, but it's usually true. And also for electronics and furniture and clothing, like doesn't matter that your clothing is made in Vietnam and then shipped to the US. Like that's still a small percentage of the environmental impacts compared to the growing the cotton and the energy that you will use when washing the shirt during its life. So anyway, although, sorry, just to continue on this tangent, it's not that transportation overall isn't a problem. Actually, transportation is one of the three biggest sustainability challenges in the world these days. The biggest three priorities for sustainability globally are basically buildings, transportation, and food. But on the transportation side, it's mostly the transportation of people and fossil fuels, not the transportation of manufactured goods. But anyway, so sorry, done with the tangent, back to your point. Transportation was a surprisingly big percentage of the environmental impacts of clinical trials because clinical trials are only done at a few hospitals. But at the same time, they want to have a wide diversity in who they test with, racial diversity, gender diversity, age diversity, other demographic diversity. So it means that you'll have these few trial sites scattered all along the US or all around the world, maybe some in rural Brazil, and in China, as well as in South Dakota and Texas or something. So there's a bunch of people that have to drive pretty long distances to get to the clinic where they get these trial drugs.
Or fly.
Yeah, the flying is rarer, but sometimes the drugs will often get flown to different places, and then that adds up too.
I'm thinking about flying here. I was thinking about flying as you were saying that, and I was going to share something here. So I have added to the screen. People who are hearing this on a podcast won't see this, but I've added to the screen a flight tracker that shows all the flights in the air right now. And that's a lot. There's tons of airplanes in the air at any time. And I'm just thinking about the environmental impact of air travel. Have you thought about that much, or has there been any thought about how to design air travel so that it reduces the energy impact?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the biggest problems with transportation globally. And it's mostly about the transportation of people. We have a few people in our department who are working on sustainable air transport research projects. I'm part of a group right now, including KLM and Airbus, where we're applying for a grant to get funds to do a research project. But who knows whether that will happen or not. So there's a bunch of stuff being done. Most of that, though, is a matter of engineering, not so much product design. Like there were other people at Delft in the aerospace faculty that were working with KLM on their flying wing design. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's a delta shape rather than a cylinder with wings. And that was supposed to reduce fuel use by like 20% or so. I don't know what the status of it is. I don't know if it's gotten beyond the research stage and going into manufacturing or not. Although actually just last year I had a group of master's students who were doing a class project for Collins Aerospace. Their project was to redesign an in-flight coffee maker. Again, taking the systems thinking approach, which we always teach them and is in the book here as well, we discovered very quickly that actually the biggest way you can improve the environmental impacts of an in-flight coffee maker is not by having greener materials or even making the coffee maker itself more energy efficient. It's by reducing the mass of the coffee maker, because every kilogram of mass that that airplane lifts up is more fuel that it burns, and that is 90 or 95% of the environmental impacts of that airplane through its whole life.
Isn't that one of the things that the space program had to research too? So, because it's even more true when you're taking things to the moon or Mars or someplace.
Absolutely. And there it's also actually in both places, both in space and in aviation, it's also just a money issue as well, because the more fuel they save, the less money they spend.
Right. You know, actually, I thought that was the first thing you were going to say about redesigning air travel was to make it all economy class.
No, actually, yes, that would help just to cram more people into the same volume.
Make it well, the other aspect of that is make American air travel so miserable that no one wants to do it. It's a plan.
I don't know if it's a design issue, but the energy footprint issue that I've been hearing about more than any other recently has been about, the energy consumption related to AI. And of course, people like to freak out about AI for all sorts of reasons. But that's one that has been, I mean, it's a huge concern because we all know that AI consumes a lot of energy and a lot of water. Is there a design approach that could improve or affect that?
There definitely is. It would be the same kinds of systems thinking and life cycle assessment and other creativity tools that we've been talking about. Well, like the book has three whole chapters on energy, actually. But in the case of AI, I'm not at all an expert on AI, but I've looked up some of the numbers just out of curiosity, and it seems like the big impact that it has in terms of energy consumption is not so much in the queries as in training the model. From what I've heard, that's where the vast majority of the energy uses. So like I don't have numbers for ChatGPT 5 or 4, but I have seen numbers for GPT-3 that consumed 1200 megawatt hours of electricity and generated over 500 tons of CO2. So that's like 500 flights from San Francisco to New York. A different AI that was trained at around the same time in France, called Bloom AI, used 1/20th of the energy. Or there's the Chinese one, which I'm blanking on the name of, that came out.
DeepSeek.
And that one claimed to have used what, 1/100th the energy or something like that. And so it's just a question of measuring the impacts of what you're doing and taking a systems approach to where you can find creative solutions so that you don't have to do that, or that if you are using all that energy, you're getting a lot more benefit from it.
The people that are creating a lot of the AI projects are moving to Texas for no other reason. Yeah, I mean, we don't have a great electrical grid, but they have very little regulation. And it's basically the Wild West of business now. And that's the only reason they're moving. And it's finally impacting a lot of conservative counties who suddenly have big data centers that are running 24/7, making a lot of noise, using a lot of electricity, a lot of water. And I don't see how that can continue to be even vaguely sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you have these sort of dogmatic ideologies against regulation. And then you find out that something moves into your backyard that you don't want to be there.
Are you using AI in your design work at all?
I am not. Honestly, mostly because I've still been very disappointed at the results that I get. And maybe I'm just not very good at using it yet. But although what I have started using it for a lot is better search. Because what I've found is that it can often give me better results than I get in like 10 Google searches or Ecosia searches. Like my sort of default search engine is Ecosia because of the profits for green initiatives thing. If that doesn't work well enough, then I'll do a Google search. But then often there, even it'll, take like 10 searches or to dig around and find what I want. And I've found that AI tools, I don't use ChatGPT. I usually use perplexity.ai because I find it hallucinates less. And if you look at the carbon footprint of queries, I've heard that an average AI query is roughly like 5 Google searches in terms of, the energy use carbon footprint. So I feel like, if it can get me as good results as 10 Google searches, then I'm having a net benefit. But yeah, there is also the slippery slope of, having the rebound effect of yes, it is probably more energy for me to do one AI search than 10 Google searches. But if I'm just going to do more searches because I can, then that, can wipe out the any of the benefits. It's only actually a benefit if I stop doing more searches and then, go on with other work.
One other thing I was going to be sure to ask you about when we're talking today is biomimicry and how that feeds into your sustainable design work.
Yeah,
so that's kind of the question.
Specific question around that, or just like open-ended question?
No, it's kind of an open-ended question about like some people probably aren't familiar with the term. So, what is biomimicry, and how does it relate to sustainable design?
Yeah. So, yeah, the general idea of biomimicry, for those that aren't familiar with it, is looking to nature for inspiration, because what better way to design things in harmony with the natural world than look at the natural world itself, right? I've used it in a bunch of design here and there. I think the place that I've gotten the best impacts from it is in green 3D printing, where I started out by Using my standard sustainable design process of looking at the whole system of a 3D printer and quantifying all the environmental impacts, you know, not just the energy use of printing, but also the materials used and the waste and making the printer and transporting it, all, you know, end of life, all that kind of stuff. And I did life cycle assessments of all of the major different technologies of polymer 3D printing. I've only measured one metal 3D printer. I'd like to do more of those, but anyway. But I found that almost all the time it was the energy use that was the biggest impact. And then the embodied impacts of the materials, you know, the plastics or other like epoxy-like polymers that were usually the second biggest impact. And so I was like, okay, well, how can I fix this? And I, you know, my first thought was to look to nature for inspiration, because nature builds things not by melting things at high temperatures and extruding it, you know, through a nozzle. There is some extrusion in nature, definitely, like spider silk is an extrusion, but it's happening at room temperature and ambient pressure with no toxic chemicals like the epoxies that some kinds of 3D printing use. And so I was like, okay, how does nature do that? Like, how does nature build things from the bottom up at room temperature and in water-based chemistry without toxic materials? It uses chemicals that either harden by drying out, like insect chitin. It's a water-based biomaterial whose chemistry, once it dries out, it creates these polymer chains that are then irreversible. So even if it gets wet again, it won't dissolve. So it's a strong, durable material. Or same thing with tree bark. It's all water-based chemistry, but then trees don't dissolve in the rain. So I replaced plastics that are being melted with upcycled agricultural waste or forestry waste, you know, sawdust or ground up nutshells or rice flour or, you know, other things like that. Dissolved in water with a binder, and then they extrude at room temperature and rely on sophisticated non-Newtonian viscosity to be able to extrude well, but then solidify as soon as they're out of the extrusion nozzle. And we measured the environmental impacts, and yeah, we cut energy use by 75 to 80 or 90%. I forget the top number. And we cut the embodied impacts of the materials by more than 80%. So we made a really radical improvement and the other thing that I loved about it, it was both biomimicry and a systems solution, because, you know, that one change of material not only changed the environmental impacts of the material, but it also changed the impacts of the energy use as well. It's not yet ready for prime time. We still haven't gotten the material strength and print quality to match plastic yet. So, you know, we need more research on it, but it's interesting stuff.
Are you confident you're going to get there?
I have no idea. If we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research, right?
I'm going to write that down somewhere.
Oh, that's an Einstein quote. I cannot take credit for that.
So what are the most essential tools that you use in your work?
Yeah, I would say the two most essential tools that I use are systems thinking and LCA, because that helps you, you know, systems thinking, particularly this method that I made up called whole system mapping, which is sort of a simple bare bones version of systems thinking. You know, it's not as fancy as like 12 leverage points or some other things that other people do, but it's much more approachable and actionable for most design companies. And I think any manufacturer or service provider, so, you know, you don't have to be a product manufacturer. You could do digital systems, you know, could do services, whatever. Anyway, the point is that systems thinking helps you step back and look at the big picture to make sure that you were solving the right problem, rather than, you know, like that hairdryer company that I talked about a while ago that worked on making a better plastic case when that was kind of fiddling while Rome burns, rather than, and it was just a waste of their time and money, you know, rather than spending their development time and money where it will actually help the most. And so as you do that systems thinking, you need to think quantitatively and, you know, so that you can figure out what your biggest impacts are, where you can have the biggest difference. And LCA is the best tool that I've found for quantifying impacts. You know, these days, a lot of people are trying new hip ways of circularity assessments. That's nice. You can also do that, but I would only do that on top of an LCA because the extent to which circular economy benefits you is only the extent to which it actually saves resource depletion, you know, mining or farming, and saves energy and stuff like that, saves environmental impacts.
I'm not sure you've ever said what LCA stands for.
Oh, sorry, life cycle assessment.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But on the other hand, you know, life cycle assessment does not measure everything. Like, it doesn't measure social impacts. You know, we've got a chapter on diversity and inclusion that has other tools that that we talk about. And people have been working on social LCA for couple decades now, but I would say it's still not ready for use as a design tool for companies. It's still a research project. It's interesting. It's just way harder to quantify social impacts than quantify environmental impacts. And also, yeah, for right, if people aren't familiar with LCA, an important note there is that it's not just measuring greenhouse gas emissions. You know, it's not just carbon emissions. It can measure 18 different kinds of environmental impact categories: acidification, eutrophication, land use, water use, mineral depletion, fossil fuel depletion, ozone, radiation, all kinds of different stuff. And so you can even make trade-offs between, you know, like with different 3D printers. I was thinking, oh, maybe these 3D printers that use a lot of energy to melt plastic, are they better or worse than these other 3D printers that just use ultraviolet light to solidify an epoxy, where, yeah, they use less energy, but those epoxies are kind of toxic chemicals. Can you make the trade-off between energy and greenhouse gas emissions versus toxicity? So again, you can quantify that stuff with LCA.
If you do manage to get the printer to the point where it really works the way that ideally it needs to work, what will you do at that point? Do you work at all on commercialization of the technologies that you work with?
So I don't personally, but we do partner with companies. So like I was talking about those two PhDs in the medical industry. So we've partnered with Johnson and Johnson and Philips, who are the ones who will actually roll out any of our improvements in design, and they'll also be the ones making money off of it.
So you wouldn't make any money off of it, or would you have patents?
In the projects, in these particular projects, I definitely will not have patents. We have intellectual property agreements with them, where, yeah, they get that stuff. But then there's other projects, where, the intellectual property is more shared. I definitely could do that if I wanted to. I don't know. I don't really care so much about that. Unless it helps to fund more research that makes, more impact in the world.
You could be a billionaire. You could be a tech bro.
Or he could live in a nice place like the Netherlands and have nationalized healthcare.
Right, exactly. I have definitely made my choice.
It sounds like a very good choice too. We're getting close to the end of the hour here, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to say something about your book, like how people can get it.
Thanks. There's a I made a URL, sdva.green, so like sustainable design vision action dot green, and that redirects to the publisher's website. You can also just search sustainable design from vision to action, and it's available at all the major booksellers, like Barnes and Noble, indie books, thrift books, stuff like that.
Libris.
That's the website right there. You can get an ebook version or paperback, and it's printed on 100% FSC certified paper with water-based inks that are de-inkable, for better paper recycling. And actually, all of the production process, all the book manufacturing, is carbon neutral, although admittedly, a bunch of that is from carbon offsets. It's not like entirely from renewable energy, but still, it was a better deal than I could get with any other publisher. So I was happy to take that deal. But anyway, so some of the things that the book teaches are stuff we've talked about, like systems thinking and LCA and biomimicry. There are also some like it has all kinds of tools and methods in it. And really the thing that sets it apart from other books is that it's actionable. It's actually a workbook. So every single chapter has an exercise that you can do for your product or service or system to design it in a better way. And that is everything from choosing greener materials to designing for better recyclability or better repair and remanufacturing. We have some very specific tools. If you have some gold in your product, like your mobile phone, and there's also some steel, if both of those are in the same recycling stream, you lose the gold because it's not compatible with steel recycling. But if you make those parts easily separated from each other and the gold is mixed in with copper and silver, like those are fine to mix together. Those recycle fine together. We have a table where you can look up stuff like that and help make these little design decisions that are detailed, but it's where, like 90% of the action happens. And it's not just technical tools and methods like that. We have two different chapters on green business models. We have a chapter on diversity and inclusion conversations. We even have a chapter on how to gather support and be a better collaborator. You know, so there's an exercise on nonviolent communication in there, just because sustainability is a highly interdisciplinary thing. No one person can do it by themselves. So you have to be in teams, and it's good to ask for the support that you need.
Oh, I just had a thought. Your book may be banned in the U.S. as too woke. It mentions diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, a chapter on diversity, I mean.
I think we can be banned for being too woke, but that's the risk we run.
Yeah, they're coming after us soon enough. Well, yeah, thanks, I mean, Jer.
If they're banning wind farms and stuff like that, this book would already be off the list anyway.
All the reason for me to go buy one.
Excellent.
We hope this right-wing stuff is just a fad. It'll pass. Okay, well, thanks, Jer. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been good to talk to you all.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.